We have been studying Christian ethics, and we come this morning to this topic of self-defense. The right to self-defense is mostly not questioned by the world. Most people in the world just assume that naturally you just have that right, and it seems to be self-evident. The challenges that come to the idea of whether or not it's right or wrong to carry out self-defense come from Christians who suggest that self-defense is in conflict with Jesus' high ethic in the Sermon on the Mount, the whole turn your other cheek ethic and forgive. Jesus said, turn the other cheek. How can I be said to be genuinely following the command, turn your other cheek, while beating up someone or shooting him because he's a threat to me? I want to begin by applauding those Christians who have that view because of the courage and commitment that it takes to hold a hard teaching that runs counter to human wisdom and believe it just because Jesus said it. And that's a commendable thing. It's a wonderful attitude. I wish we would all develop faith so that we would be more like that on that. But on the other hand, as we learned last week, we need to be careful to think through the context and intent of what Jesus said in the Sermon on the Mount so that we don't apply those commands in inappropriate contexts. And I think that the self-defense issue is actually an inappropriate context in which to apply the turn your other cheek command. Matthew 5:38, Jesus said, you have heard it was said, eye for eye and tooth for tooth, but I tell you, do not resist an evil person. If someone strikes you on the right cheek, turn to him also the other. And if someone wants to sue you and take your tunic, let him have your cloak as well. If someone forces you to go 1 mile, go with him 2 miles. Give to the one who asks you, and do not turn away from the one who wants to borrow from you. Now, before deciding whether or not this addresses the issue of self-defense, let's look carefully at Jesus' intent. What is he trying to say? What is this command designed to teach us? This is the section on the Sermon on the Mount where Jesus is correcting their misinterpretations of the Old Testament law. You have heard it was said, but I say unto you. And he gives them a false interpretation that they're saying, and then he corrects it and says, but I say unto you, and then here's the right way. And the issue at hand here has to do with the topic of revenge. And the correct interpretation of the Old Testament teaching on revenge is really pretty simple. Don't take revenge. Don't be vengeful. Leave that to God. Deuteronomy 32:35, it is mine to avenge, I will repay. Proverbs 20:22, do not say, I will pay you back for this wrong. Wait for Yahweh and he will deliver you. Proverbs 24:29, do not say, I'll do to him as he has done to me. I'll pay back the man for what he did. Don't do that. Let the Lord take care of it. So don't take revenge. Now, that's what the Old Testament teaches. Now let's look at their misinterpretation of the Old Testament. Verse 38, you have heard it was said, eye for eye, tooth for tooth. And that's the false interpretation. You say, whoa, wait a minute. How could that be false? That's a quote from the Bible. It's false because it's a quote from the Bible that's misapplied. It's false because it's a quote from the Bible that's applied in an inappropriate context. Eye for eye and tooth for tooth is not, remember we found last week, that is designed for justice in government's actions. It's not designed for interpersonal relationships. And so it's misapplied. When you use that as an excuse to take revenge in a personal relationship, you're misapplying it. It was for purpose of law courts to limit. And so the Old Testament command is to limit vindictiveness. They were using the Old Testament to allow for vindictiveness. And the whole point, it was designed to limit vindictiveness even in the law courts, because in the law courts, the tendency in the ancient time was to overpunish. And we tend to do that in general, in personal relationships. You escalate the situation in excess of the crime. Right? You mess with my pickup truck, I'll shoot you. That kind of thing. That tendency to escalate, it's obvious when you stop to think of the fact that there are murders, right? Obviously that's an escalation. Because nobody ever murdered somebody in retaliation for having been murdered by that person, right? Obviously. So it's always an escalation. Revenge is that way. It always steps up the level of punishment. In fact, some people even take pride in it, like Lamech, who was bragging about the fact that he killed a man for injuring him. Have you ever been around people like that that'll brag about, like, I don't take any guff from anybody. You know, he said one word to me, I just let him have it. And there's a retaliatory spirit in man that is deeply rooted in our fallen, sinful hearts. And it's there from birth. I mean, it's there. You can remember it from the time you were a little kid. That's all kids have that. I mean, that's why. I mean, how many times you see that in a little kid? You break up a fight, you say, "What happened?" It all started when he hit me back, right? I mean, it's always in retaliation to something. And it's the same way with adults. Feuds go on for generations. Happens in marriages. Happens between nations. 4,000 years ago, some tension between two women over an issue of jealousy, and the conflict rages today between the children of Sarah and the children of Hagar. And who knows how many have been killed as a result of that. A small offense occurs, the person wants to get even, but does even more, and then he thinks now they're even, but the other one doesn't think they're even. The other one thinks now he owes, and so he does something, and now he thinks they're even, but you don't think, and it just goes on for, can go on for millennia. And it'll go on forever until somebody is big enough to rise above the conflict and take a blow or two without retaliating. And just put the issue to rest. And that's what Jesus is calling us to do in personal relationships, to break that chain of aggression, to stop the getting each other back. That eye for an eye law was for the law courts, not personal relationships, and we don't want the courts to behave like personal relationships, and we don't want personal relationships to behave like the law courts. A judge in California I read about felt sorry for a rapist, and so he let him go. And immediately the guy went out and raped and murdered a 9-year-old girl. Is that judge good or bad? Bad. It's a terrible judge. You don't want a law court to tell a criminal, we forgive you, don't feel bad, and we want you to know that if you go out and do it again, we'll forgive you 70 times 7, however many times. We don't want a law court to say that. It'd be chaos. The courts are responsible for justice. But here Jesus is speaking at the level of personal relationships, and he's saying you need to stop vindictiveness. When a person commits a crime, he's committed a sin in three directions. He's committed a sin against the victim, against society, and against God. And he owes a debt to all three. And the victim can forgive him, but that one part of the sin, but he can't forgive the debt against God and against society. He can only forgive sins against you. But you should forgive all sins against you. Our society has it completely backwards. God calls for justice in the law courts and mercy in personal relationships. And what do we want to do? Mercy in the law courts and justice in personal relationships. The exact opposite of God's standard. They want us to forgive the criminals, and yet they'll carry out vendettas and retaliate when they're wrong. We're in a mode in our culture of demanding rights, and when your rights are violated, we want to retaliate. And we have a whole society like that, demanding rights. And the result of that is always going to be fighting. Now, there's nothing wrong with rights, but the biblical perspective on rights is that rights are something that extended to people. The problem comes when a society moves from extending rights to demanding rights. You see the difference? When Jesus, what you do with a right is you give it to someone. You don't demand it for yourself. So when Jesus states the wrong view here, he does quote the Bible because they were misusing a Bible verse. You can hold to a Bible verse and still have a wrong view if you're inappropriately applying it. The Old Testament command was intended to forbid revenge, and they were using it to justify revenge. Now, let's look at verse 39. He says, I tell you, don't resist an evil person. And what he's getting at here is don't take revenge. And then he gives three illustrations of what he means. Forgive, don't resist an evil person in three areas. Number one, when you have an assault on your dignity or on your pride, look what he says. If someone strikes you on the right cheek, turn to him the other also. A right-handed person, now picture this scene. Somebody is striking you on the right cheek. So if you got a right-handed person striking you on the right cheek, it would require a backhanded slap, right? That's the picture. That was especially insulting to a Jew. In fact, it was against the law. It was against Roman law and Jewish law to do that. It allowed you to press charges because it was such an insult. It's not that it would create so much injury or anything like that. It's just such an insult. So what Jesus is saying here, he's not talking about allowing yourself to get beaten to a pulp. The picture is you're in a dispute with someone, escalates to the point where he does something that's especially insulting to you. And suddenly you realize this is wrong, and you stop trying to win, and you humble yourself, and you don't retaliate, and then he sends another volley, and then you get the same response. That's the idea. That's what Jesus is saying. That's what it means to turn the other cheek. You say, well, wait a minute, what if it's more than an insult? I mean, I can handle that with an insult. I can turn the other cheek when it comes to an insult. But what if it's an outright attack? It's not a slap, but it's a punch. I don't think Jesus is talking about that. He's talking here about an insult. What Jesus is pointing out is the importance of avoiding sin of a vengeful, retaliatory spirit that wants to take revenge. That involves sin, and it would be better to take another blow than to get into that sin. Anger and retaliation always lead us into sin. An example of that is Paul in Acts 23. Remember when they struck him and he got mad? I'll read it to you. Acts 23:1. Paul looked straight at the Sanhedrin and said, "My brothers, I have fulfilled my duty to God in all good conscience to this day." And at this, the high priest Ananias ordered those standing near Paul to strike him on the mouth, which is illegal. And so they punched him. And then Paul said to him, "God strike you, you whitewashed wall. And you sit there and judge me according to the law, and yet you yourself violate the law by commanding that I be struck." And those who were standing there said to Paul, "You dare insult God's high priest?" And Paul replied, "Oh, brothers, I didn't realize that he was the high priest, for it is written, 'Do not speak evil about the ruler of your people.'" Paul's initial response was vengeance, and it led him right into a sin, and he had to apologize. You contrast that with Jesus, who they punched Jesus too. 1 Peter 2:23, when they hurled their insults at him, he did not retaliate, and when he suffered, he made no threats. Instead, he entrusted himself to him who judges justly. In fact, Isaiah 50, verse 6 says, "I offered my back to those who beat me, my cheeks to those who pulled out my beard. I did not hide my face from mocking and spitting." So it's the beautiful spirit of our Lord. It's the spirit of Joseph and David, who refused to take revenge on Saul and wept at his death. It's the beautiful spirit of Stephen, who said, "Don't hold this sin against them." Someone insults, humiliates you, puts you down, you turn the other cheek. You don't retaliate. In fact, if need be willing to accept another blow. If need be. There's nothing to be gained if it's not necessary. But if it will achieve some good, then be willing to do that. You respond in anger, it's just going to lead to other sins, and it's not worth doing that to your own spiritual life. Because vengeance is an indication of a complete defeat in your spiritual life. We find that in 1 Corinthians 6. Verse 7 says, "The very fact that you have lawsuits among you means that you have been completely defeated already. Why not rather be wronged? Why not rather be cheated? Instead, you yourselves cheat and do wrong, and you do this to your brothers." So it's better to be wronged, better to turn the other cheek, better to be cheated than to be completely defeated spiritually and to take revenge. Even in the church, the people are very often offended and hold it against the person, and they don't do anything obvious. They just withhold their affection. They just withhold their love from that person in the church. That same thing happens in marriage. Husband does something that embarrasses the wife, and she, you know, maybe brings it up in public the next time so he can get a taste of his own medicine or something like that. That kind of thing. Jesus said, "Don't resist evil. Don't retaliate." And then he illustrates it by telling us, "Don't do that when there's an assault on your pride." That's number one illustration. Now, in verse 40, you see the second way. When there's an assault on your possessions, on your stuff. Verse 40, "If someone wants to sue you and take your tunic, let him have your cloak as well." Now, it doesn't say if somebody wants your tunic, give him your cloak. The idea is he's suing. So the idea here is you have wronged the person and you're being sued by him, and evidently he wins and gets your tunic. When that happens, not only do you avoid retaliating, but you want to generously give to that person. He sues for your tunic, you give him your cloak. That would sound absolutely outrageous to these people, because your cloak, the tunic was the long undershirt, the cloak is the outer garment which they used as a blanket at night when they would sleep. They wore two things, a tunic and a cloak. If you don't have your tunic and you don't have your cloak, guess what? You don't have anything on. And So for that reason, a Jew could not be sued for his cloak. You cannot sue for a Jew's cloak, but you could for his tunic. Jesus is saying, if someone sues you for the shirt off your back, take off all your clothes and give them to him. That's what he's saying. Obviously, we're missing the point if we interpret that in a legalistic way. He's not promoting nudism. It's a hyperbole. He's saying, do whatever you possibly can to go out of your way to make things right. Just give extra from your end to make things right. And when you do that, it keeps your heart from angry, vengeful retaliation, because you're giving to the person. And not only that, but you may win your brother by doing that. And so you turn a double loss into a pure gain. If you've gained your brother, you've gained much more than a garment or a cloak. So give to the person. If someone assaults your possessions, then become giving. And go out of your way to make things right. And then number three, Jesus says, talks about assaults on, you could say, assault on your freedom. If someone forces you to go 1 mile, go with them 2 miles. Soldiers did that. Jews hated the Romans anyway. They especially hated this. You can imagine how this went over when some Roman soldier would say, okay, you have to carry my pack 1 mile. And it's really 2 miles anyway, because you have to carry it 1 mile, and you have to walk 1 mile back to where you started to go wherever it was you were going. I'm sure they did that with grudging every step. And I don't know if you've ever thought about that, but if you can imagine just driving around and then all of a sudden some police officer pulls you over and says, I don't know what you had planned, but you're taking this package to Fort Collins for me right now. Go. You know, I mean, that would be a big enough interruption even if you didn't have to walk. But that's the kind of thing they faced. Jesus said, go ahead and go even an extra mile. So then you go 2 miles and then 2 miles back, so 4 miles. Just be willing to give up your rights for someone else's benefits is the idea. T.W. Manson said, the first mile renders to Caesar the things that are Caesar's. The second mile renders to God the things that are God's. That's a great statement, isn't it? That's why you do it. You go out of your way and go above and beyond what's required, even when there's an assault on your freedom. So then the summary comes in verse 42. Give to the one who asks of you, and do not turn away from the one who wants to borrow from you. Be generous. And that's nothing new either. Deuteronomy 15:7. If there's a poor man among your brothers of any towns in the land that Yahweh your God has given you, then do not be hard-hearted or tight-fisted toward your poor brother. Rather, be open-handed and freely lend to him whatever he needs. The solution to conflict is grace. Giving from a heart of love. Have an overflowing, generous, loving attitude toward everyone, even your opponents. Now, there are sometimes when it's not the way of love to give. It's not loving to give in many contexts. For example, to panhandlers or spoiled children or thieves or things like that. Sometimes it's good to withhold. And we don't want to invite crime or to be reckless or endanger ourselves and fail to care for our loved ones and run out of money and all that. We have to have wisdom in how we apply this. But whether or not to give should be decided by love rather than our regard for our personal possessions. Love should make the call. So, we've been given grace, we've been given mercy, right? We've experienced what one guy said is the surprise of unexpected grace. Shouldn't we be willing to extend that same thing to our enemies? And this is one reason why it's so important to understand how undeserved the grace we received really was. The more you think of yourself as deserving to be saved, the less room there is for grace, and the less grace you're going to give because the less grace you think you received. All right, that's a summary of the point that Jesus was making. I want to go through a whole thing so you understand the context, that we really do take what Jesus, the turn your other cheek passage, seriously if we do all those things that we just covered. However, does that apply to the idea of defending yourself against crime? You're not supposed to take vengeance or retaliate. Is it appropriate to apply that to the situation when you're actually under attack? Well, the answer is yes, in one sense. If someone attacks you, you shouldn't be vindictive, and you shouldn't desire to retaliate or be angry or hate the person or try and get even with the person, no matter what the attack is. However, it would be inappropriate to use Jesus' words to forbid self-defense. I don't think that's what Jesus is getting at. The highest law is the law of love, and we are to love our neighbors ourselves, and it's not loving to take revenge, and so we ought never to take revenge. But does that mean that it is loving to allow a person to commit a crime against you or your family? And I don't think so. And I think we can point to Exodus 22:2, which says, if a thief is caught breaking in and is struck so that he dies, the defender is not guilty of bloodshed. But if it happens after sunrise, then he is guilty of bloodshed. You can kill him at night, but not at day. That's the idea. The point of verse 3 is that if it's a situation when the person can be safely apprehended, then it's wrong to kill him. Don't kill him if you can safely apprehend him. However, if it's uncertain whether he can be safely apprehended, and he's presenting a threat, and you kill him, you bear no guilt. That's what it's saying. God was providing for self-defense and defending one's family by means of killing. And that doesn't violate the law of love at all. In fact, it upholds it. If I walk in on an intruder and he's got a gun, say he's making his way down the hall towards our bedroom and I'm behind him and I have a gun, if that's the case, if I allow him to go ahead and commit the greater crime of rape or murder or whatever it is he's going to try and commit and invite greater judgment on himself, that's not necessarily loving to the intruder or to my family. I think it's loving to prevent someone from carrying out evil, especially with something like murder. Now, if you can preserve his life and give him another chance at repentance, that's good. But if all that would do is put you at more risk, you know, if you shoot him in the foot or something, and he's got a gun, he might turn around and shoot you in the head, I mean, that might just put you at more risk, then maybe it's not a wise thing to do. So I think based on the principle of Exodus 22, we see that God, by allowing for self-defense, even killing someone out of self-defense, means that he didn't intend the laws against vengeance to apply to self-defense. Does that make sense? Now, there's another passage that's used very often in the issue of self-defense, and that's Luke 22. Luke 22:35, and this is a highly disputed passage. I'll just read it to you and I'll give you my thoughts about it. It says, then Jesus asked them, when I sent you out without a purse, bag, or sandals, did you lack anything? Nothing, they answered. Now let me tell you what that's all about. This is after he trained his disciples for a while, and then he sent them out on this little short-term mission thing. He said, go out and do this, and don't go to the Gentiles, just go to the Jews, and then come back. And so they did that. And you know, when they came back, they kind of debriefed, and Jesus trained them. When he sent them out that time, he says, don't take any supplies. So I want you to learn something. I want you to learn how I'm going to take care of you. So just do an experiment here. Don't take any supplies with you. Don't take any money. Don't take any extra sandals. Just go. And they got back, and he says, now, did you lack anything? They said, no. Worked out great. We had everything we needed. So that was then. Now, Jesus is getting ready to die. This is Luke 22. And he said to them, but now if you have a purse, take it, and also a bag, and if you don't have a sword, sell your cloak and buy one. It is written, and he was numbered with the transgressors, and I'll tell you that this must be fulfilled in me. Yes, what is written about me is reaching its fulfillment. The disciples said, see, Lord, here are two swords. That is enough, he replied. Kind of an odd passage. A little bit hard to interpret, and it's been variously interpreted. And I looked at about 10 commentaries, and all 10 of them came to the same conclusion that Jesus was not instructing his disciples to actually acquire swords and use them. That's what all the commentaries that I looked at said. And many of the older commentators suggested that Jesus was talking about spiritual swords here. Evidently, they're so expensive you have to sell your spiritual cloak to get one. I don't think that's a possibility because in verse 35, Jesus established that he's discussing literal purses, literal bags, literal sandals, and literal swords because that's what he told them not to take in the first outing. The most common pacifist interpretation is that Jesus wants them to buy swords in order that they might appear as outlaws. That's the most common interpretation that I read. And what they say is verse 37 is saying Jesus, because verse 37 he says, and it's written, he was numbered with the transgressors. He says, I've got to be, in order to fulfill this prophecy of Isaiah 53, I've got to be numbered with the transgressors. I've got to be thought of as being an outlaw. And so go buy some swords so people will think we're a bunch of outlaws. Jesus, they say Jesus couldn't have been, they come up with these kind of interpretations because they say he can't be talking about self-defense by means of a sword. Because two swords, for one thing, is hardly enough to defend 12 guys. And secondly, it would violate Jesus' ethic of turn the other cheek. Regarding that second argument, and that's really the compelling one, the one that drives everything, I just am not persuaded by it because, as we've seen, the turn the other cheek argument doesn't have anything to do with self-defense. And so that frees us up to just take this, read this in a straightforward way, and I think it is most, the most natural way to take this is Jesus is telling them that they're going to face some tough times and they need to defend themselves. And two swords, I think, is plenty. I don't know about you, but if I were a bandit lurking on a road somewhere, and here comes 12 guys, two of them armed, I wouldn't mess with them. Maybe you would, but I wouldn't.
Because they're only wearing tunics,
right? Yeah, right. That's right. They don't have any cloaks, but they do have swords.
Daryl, is there any distinction between, it says it is enough, that's what Jesus said. Is there some reason he wouldn't have said they are enough?
It's an odd statement no matter how you interpret it. The question is about it is enough. Sounds like a strange statement, and it is. And it's very widely interpreted a lot of different ways. Let me go through the rest of this, and then I'll give my argument for why I interpret the way I do. I really think that two swords would be enough for self-defense, but on the other hand, I think that argument works the opposite way. Do we really think that the Roman Empire would regard two swords as a serious uprising against the government? I don't think the prophecy about Jesus being numbered with the transgressors refers to the disciples at all. It seems a lot more likely to me that it's talking about Jesus being crucified as a common criminal among other criminals. Even though it's a minority view, I really think the best way to interpret this passage is a straightforward statement that Jesus is telling them, look, things are going to get tough. He said, last time I sent you out, things were smooth. Everything worked out fine. You got everything you needed. Provisions were there. Money was there. You got what you needed. It's not going to be that way this time. It's going to be tough. You're going to need, if you got a purse, take it. If you got money, you better take it. If you don't have a sword, you better get one. Because things are going to be hard. It's going to be rough. You're going to be under attack. And the verse 37, he was numbered with transgressors. It doesn't say do this in order to fulfill this prophecy. Look carefully at what it says. He says, do this because this prophecy is reaching its fulfillment. It's about to be fulfilled. I'm about to be regarded as an outlaw. It's about to happen that I'm going to be looked at as an outlaw, and you as my followers will also be looked at that way. Life's going to get really hard. And another thing that these commentators say that take these other views is that they say, well, Jesus rebuked Peter for using his sword at the arrest. Therefore, Jesus is against swords. But Jesus always rebuked Peter when Peter tried to prevent Jesus from going to the cross. That's nothing new. Peter kept on trying to prevent Jesus from going to the cross, and Jesus always rebuked him for that. Jesus isn't talking here about fighting Rome and preventing Jesus' arrest. That would be wrong. And two swords wouldn't be adequate for that. It's obvious here that he isn't talking about war with Rome. He tells them to get four things: a sword, a purse, a bag, and sandals. Right? Now that is not what you get to go to war. That's not talking about war utensils. He's talking about basic provisions for life in a rough world. A sword's not for attacking Rome. It's for self-defense along the dangerous roads where there were so many thieves and bandits. So in verse 38, the disciples said, see, Lord, here are two swords. That is enough, he replied. Now, this is where most of the commentators say Jesus is saying this in exasperation because they ignored the point about the bag and the sandals and they just focused on the sword and they picked up on the sword thing. And so Jesus gets fed up and he says, that is enough. Now, that kind of talk, I've had it with you guys. And he walks out. I really have a hard time seeing that here, frankly. Jesus gets exasperated and rebukes them for picking up on the sword comment. Jesus is the one that highlighted the sword. He's the one that emphasizes the sword comment. He says to them, look at verse 36. He says, if you have a purse, take it. If you have a bag, take it. But if you don't have a sword, sell your cloak and buy one. Is he not emphasizing that above the other things? The other ones, if you happen to have them, then take them along. But the sword, make sure you get one. If you don't have one, sell your cloak to get one. The cloak, like I said, is what they used to keep warm at night. It was their sleeping bag. He's basically saying it's better to be cold and miserable than to be and not be able to get any sleep than to be caught out there without a sword. Because it's better to be cold than dead, right? That's what he's saying. Now you say, why don't we ever use... So I think that it is enough is talking about the swords. It can be taken any way. It just says that is enough. The thing that it can refer to whatever the context demands that it refer to. And I really don't think that he's talking about their words and in exasperation, because they're not that far off of what he's directing them to do. He makes a big point about the sword, and then they say, well, we've got two swords, and then he's going to get mad at that? I don't think so. I really think the best way to take it is just two swords is enough. The next question comes, well, why don't we ever see them using these swords and axes? I mean, they encounter a lot of hostility and opposition and axes. Why don't they use the swords? And that brings up the question of how should we respond to persecution? And this was really my interest in doing this study, is what about persecution? If self-defense is okay, are we supposed to use self-defense when we're being persecuted? What should we do in face of persecution? I mean, we remember when we were doing Matthew 24 and we got to that part about the tribulation and people were saying, well, what should we... You know, when that happens, should we resist? Should we hide? Should we flee? Should we just stand and proclaim the truth that whatever happens? If you're in a country, if that happens in our country where it's illegal to preach the gospel, what should we do? Should we go into underground churches and sneak around and do it so that we can continue to carry out the gospel? Or should we do it out in the open and just get thrown into jail? I mean, what should we do with persecution? And I think it's an area where we follow Jesus' example. Throughout much of his ministry, Jesus fled persecution. I don't think it's necessarily wrong to flee persecution. When they tried to kill him, up until the time that it was the right time, every time before that, with the many times they tried to kill him, he would flee. And when the time came that he couldn't flee without violating God's will, then he willingly gave himself up to them. I think that's an example for us. If persecution can be avoided without harming a ministry, avoid it. Just avoid it. But if not, if you can't carry out the ministry by avoiding it, then just accept it. Accept the persecution. But I don't think persecution is a time when we're to exercise self-defense. I think the passages in the Bible that call for self-defense are not talking about persecution, and I think that's why you don't see the disciples using the sword in Acts when they're being persecuted. Because it's not appropriate to defend yourself in that case. I think you use the sword to protect yourself. Self-defense you use in the case of crime against you, other crimes outside of persecution, but not persecution. And that's just, I'm just saying, going by example from the New Testament. Martin Luther, that was his view. He said, if I were attacked by robbers, I should wield the sword. Luther, he's kind of funny. He says, I should wield the sword because no one else would be near me to protect me. I should strike as many dead as I could. And should consider myself to have done a good work. But if I were attacked as a preacher for the sake of the gospel, I should fold my hands and say, well, my Christ, here I am. I have preached thee. If my time has come, I commit myself into your hands, and thus I should die. I think that's a good attitude. That's really what Luther did. I don't know if he realized that he would use these very words, here I stand, almost the same words, when the persecution did come. But I think that's the standard. Okay. Any questions or comment? That's a very good question. I should have included that. In fact, I was going to, and then I forgot about it. But I'm glad you brought it up. The question is about jihad, holy war. And the Muslims, of course, use the idea of a holy war as an excuse to do all kinds of violence, killing the infidels and all that. And you can think about the Crusades and some of the stuff that happened there, or the Inquisition, and some people wonder, well, what is it wrong to fight? If it's okay to fight a war, you know, to protect ourselves physically, why wouldn't it be right to fight a war to protect ourselves spiritually? Maybe we should get the sword out against the cults or something, And is it okay to, I mean, should we maybe do that? Should we be zealous enough for the name of God, like in the Old Testament, to where we actually take physical action against the false teachers who are leading people into hell? Isn't it better to just kill one false teacher and then have not so many people go to hell? The answer to that question, I think, is in Jesus' parable about the weeds, the wheat and the tares, you know. A lot of people apply that only to the church. They'll say that the wheat is the true Christians, the tares, the weeds, are the phony Christians that look just like the real Christians, and they're in there in the church, and what he's saying there is don't kick them out of the church, let them, you know, let God sort them out at the end and let them stay together for now. Because what Jesus said in the parable is, there's a guy with a field of wheat, the enemy comes and sows these tare seeds, and I've seen these in Oklahoma, they look exactly like wheat at the beginning, you can't tell the difference. And so they say, what should we do? Should we go pull up the tares? And the guy says, no, don't do that, because you'll end up pulling the wheat with it. Just let them grow together, and then we'll sort it out at the harvest. And then Jesus interprets the parable. And you remember what he says the field is? That's where people, I think, miss the thing. He doesn't say the field is the church. The field is the world, right? The world. Field is the world. The wheat are the believers. The tares are all unbelievers. And I think what he's saying is you don't go out, the way to apply the parable is you don't go out and do something like the Muslims do. You don't go out in a holy war or jihad and kill off unbelievers. Because in doing so, you might end up killing people who are believers or who are going to become believers. Just let them continue and let God sort it out at Judgment Day. So I think that parable would be what would forbid us from taking physical action against unbelievers because of the fact that they're unbelievers.
Plus, if you kill them, they would never have a chance to leave.
Right, that's right. I think that's the point of the parable. They might end up being weak before they die. So,
you know, as a Christian, and I'm just going to make this up, but, you know, somebody comes and they need something from you, and you give them something, and then pretty soon they need more. And need,
yeah, I think that's why I threw in a little comment about sometimes it's not the way of love to give, because it's not a loving act. If you give to someone who is not willing to work or who just squanders what he has or is foolish, sometimes it's more loving to allow that person to struggle than it is to just keep feeding them money. And so I think in a case like that, it's not a violation of the command, because it's not any greed or vindictiveness that you're not giving to them. It's really out of concern for them. If you really feel like you can spiritually help somebody again and again by helping them financially, then maybe it's worth putting yourself through financial hardship to help them. But if you're not going to do them any spiritual good, then it's probably most loving not to. Comment on that?
Yeah. I just had that happen to me about a week ago. About spiritual things. She had no interest in spiritual things.
Yeah. When somebody makes it clear that they don't have any interest in spiritual things, I don't think we have a responsibility to provide their spiritual needs. God hasn't promised to do that. He's promised to take care of believers. And that's our policy. People call the church all the time. Just like that. You can tell they're going down the phone book and calling all the churches. And we're in the Yellow Pages several times, so we'll always get two or three calls from the same person. And they don't even realize it until I give them the same answer, and then they recognize the answer. But they always say, you know, I've called all these churches, and they're, you know, the deacons can't be reached, or their benevolence fund is empty, or whatever. And I always say the same thing. Our benevolence fund has plenty of money in it, and our deacons can be reached, and I can make the decision myself, but we're not going to give you any money. We will help them if they say, I need a place to stay. Usually they'll say, I need a place to stay. Can you just help me out with the rent for 2 days? Then my husband's going to be back, and then we'll do this. And I always say the same thing. I said, I'll help you try and find a place to stay. We won't give you money, but we'll help you try and find a place to stay. And usually they get really angry and hang up. But I still offer that anyway, because every once in a while there's someone, mostly it's just crackpot, but every once in a while it's someone legit. Like, that's what happened with Christine. That's how we got Christine. Christine called. She says, I need some help. I said, oh, another crackpot. I said, well, we'll see if we can. And it turns out she actually just did need some help. And she ended up staying with Naomi. You gave her a place to stay, right? Isn't that right? And then, so now we've had Christine all this time just because of that. So you never know. But Yeah. So if somebody has some kind of interest in spiritual things, you know, we're raring to go to help them out financially, however they need it. But if they're just refusing to work, you know, then it's not loving. Now, about parents and children, your other part of your question. With your kids, it's both. And this is where a lot of parents don't understand. There's a lot of parents who won't discipline their kids because they think, I got to be forgiving. And you got to understand, you're both the government and their friend. I mean, I'm Josiah's authority and his brother in Christ. And so if my son or my daughters do something that hurts me, I should be forgiving. I shouldn't retaliate. I shouldn't get them back. I shouldn't be angry at them. However, as their parents, my responsibility to give them a consequence, a significant consequence. So I think some parents feel like they'll never raise their voice at their children, or they'll never treat them harshly or give them a harsh punishment, because they feel like, well, if I do that, I'm coming unglued. Or people will think I'm coming unglued. But it's possible to do that and not come unglued. Is God not wrathful and angry in Scripture? He's not coming unglued. He's under control. He's just doing what's right. And so I think there's a place for very harsh response if it calls for a harsh response. But don't do it out of vengeance. Don't do it because you're angry at the kid or you're trying to get the kid back. But do it. I mean, some parents, they say, well, I'm angry, therefore I can't punish. You ever heard that? Don't ever punish in anger. And so they say, well, I'm angry, so my hands are tied. I can't punish. No. Punish away. Just try and get rid of your anger. Do the punishment you need to do, but in the meantime, do your best to get rid of your anger. So, just like a judge sentencing a rapist. He shouldn't be angry and vindictive against the rapist. And if he's got an anger problem, then we want him to work on his anger problem. But in the meantime, go ahead and sentence the guy as he should be sentenced.
Would you draw maybe a distinction there between a type of self-defense that's purely defensive and fighting?
Yeah, I think I really think of the question is the difference between self-defense that's just defense and self-defense that's fighting back. I mean, if somebody's pummeling me, I can go like this and protect my face, or I can go like this and stop the pummeling, you know, maybe and knock him out, you know, or whatever. That kind of trade-off, I don't know. I mean, that's kind of a judgment call that I think you'd have to discern. I really see even fleeing as a form of self-defense. Running away, Jesus running away from people trying to kill him, that's a form of self-defense. I think it's instructive that we see Jesus doing that. We don't see Jesus just flattening him like he did with the soldiers, you know, at the arrest. So generally speaking, I think the most peaceful possible way of defending yourself, as long as it's adequate, should be the first course.
What about defending others?
All the principles we talked about defending self, I think, also apply to defending others, like your family, or those over whom you have responsibility. So I would apply it the same way. And the idea of vengeance and vindictiveness also applies to defending others. Some people think, you know, there are some women who think, somebody's trashing my husband, the boss at work's treating my husband like garbage, he's making his life miserable, therefore I'm justified, since I love my husband, I'm justified in being angry at his boss. You're not hurting me, he's hurting my husband. No, you're not justified in holding a grudge. You're not justified in being angry. The same thing applies. That boss is hurting you by hurting your husband. And so you still need to be forgiving, and you still need to turn the other cheek. However, the things about self-defense also apply. The same principles. Does that make sense?
You kind of qualified that answer with a relative or somebody that you're an authority over. Okay, suppose it's a stranger who has come across as being...
Yeah. Well, I said over those over whom you have some responsibility or whatever. What I meant by that is when it's your responsibility to act, and that would include your neighbor, who is anybody in front of you with a need, like the Good Samaritan story. So I think if you're just going, you know, if you're the Good Samaritan and you get there a little earlier while they're beating the guy up, then you ought to see if you... Let's close in a word of prayer. Father, thank you so much for this time together. And thank you for giving us clear guidelines on even difficult ethical questions. And Lord, I pray that most of all these principles we talked about, most of all, we're concerned about responding the right way to persecution. You said anyone who lives godly in Christ will suffer persecution. We seek to to do that, and so we anticipate persecution, and we pray that we would respond in just the right with wisdom, in just the right way, in the most loving way, and in the most courageous way. We pray this in your holy name. Amen.